Amen. Okay, we've been talking about a lot of different different elements to this. We've been constructing something by looking at different elements. And what I want to do today and tomorrow is to give you a framework from which all the primary source stuff we've been talking about, all the deconstructing and reconstructing of the principles of interp stuff we've been talking about, a framework within which that will make sense. So that's what my goal is for today and tomorrow, is to say, okay, everything we've talked about so far, now let's figure out how we can put these pieces together into a methodology from which we can impact our interpretation of our biblical texts. Does that make sense? After we finish these next 2 days, we'll then go into some Roman history, we'll go into some Roman society, and then eventually that'll lead us past the oral exam time we were supposed to have. So, today what I want to begin to talk about is what's been emerging in the past 15 to 20 years, and it's really gained a lot of steam now, and this came really to the forefront of my observation or whatever you want to say, at the British New Testament Conference. After I was there, I was like, okay, these lectures actually are worthy of being talked about. Because one of the consistent questions at the end of every single lecture was a question that revolved around the idea of how does our political understanding of the empire impact this particular lecture? Every lecture had at least one question that was asking that question. And the reason why is because we've been developing this the last 15 to 20 years. And we'll talk about, matter of fact, we're going to go through the whole history of it in just a minute. But it's really just now starting to emerge. Whenever an idea begins to develop in scholarship, it's kind of like at a church. There's a principle at church that if you are going to announce something, you announce it 7 times before everyone will finally start to understand that you're doing something. Like, and even at that point, they'll say, okay, now what is this? This is the first time I've heard of it. It'll be about the 7th time. And that's not to criticize, and that's just a reality. It is what it is. That's why marketing, you'll have the same commercial over and over and over and over within any given set of a show or the Super Bowl or whatever, because repetition is what actually gets it into people's minds and heads. Therefore, in scholarship, whenever a thought emerges, it'll take 15, 20 to 25 years before you really feel the full effects of that. And we are right now in the middle of the effects of what I call empire studies. And hopefully the signal will allow the definition of it to come up there. Because that may be something I'll ask you to define at the oral exam. And the definition of it that I'm giving it is this. Empire studies and biblical scholarship is the interpretive framework. Notice what I'm using, that language right there that I'm using. Interpretive framework. This is everything that we've been, all the elements, this is the framework within which it'll actually able to gain some flesh. The interpretive framework that focuses on investigating, interrogating, and reconstructing the socio-political milieu of the author and recipient, and notice the parentheses S, because there could be more than one author or more than one recipient. Where is there more than one author that we know of in the New Testament? For one book. He admits it, yeah. 1 Thessalonians, does it not? This letter is coming from Paul, Timothy, and what is it, and Silvanus? Right? So, who's writing what? Well, they probably all had a hand in it. Anyway, that's the parenthesis S there. The author and recipient of the biblical text. Now, notice what I have in bold and in italics, because this is the major contribution of empire studies. Consistently focusing on the relationship or interaction between the empire and its subjects. So I'm going to read it again, and I'm going to be talking through it. I know I'm trying to give you guys time to write it, to copy it down. Empire studies in biblical scholarship is the interpretive framework. It is the methodology that focuses on investigating, interrogating, and reconstructing, doing whatever we can to once again rebuild the socio-political milieu, the environment, the atmosphere, the world in which the author and the recipients were living. The socio-political milieu of the author and the recipients of the biblical text. And the way that this is done is by consistently focusing on the relationship or the interaction, the way in which the empire and its subjects are relating to each other or interacting with each other between the empire and its subjects. Do you understand the definition? I'm not asking if you understand the methodology. I'm asking if you understand the definition. Yes?
Why is consistently so important?
Because, and we'll talk about this, and when we go through the history, this question will become more clear, but I'll give you an initial answer. What empire studies, it's not that no one before the last 15, 20 years has ever talked about the empire or the relationship between the empire and the documents. It's not like that's never come on the scene. The difference is whenever somebody says, no, I'm going to trace this consistently through the entire document. And I'm going to give you an imperial reading of this document. And it's not necessarily to supplant all other readings of the document, but it's to add a facet to the document that hasn't really been consistently focused on before. Yes, your projects, you are engaging in empire studies, whether you knew it or not. Why? Because that's where scholarship's at right now, and I think that that's appropriate for 400 level students to know where scholarship is, where it's moving. Because if you don't know where scholarship is right now, whenever 5 years to 10 years down the road, whenever it shifts, you won't even know what it has shifted from. But what you find, and we'll talk about this in a minute, is that there are multiple different influences in any given paradigm that either causes a paradigm shift or causes a paradigm to progress and move forward. And right now, this is the paradigm that we're functioning in New Testament studies. I mean, you may not like the paradigm, but you can't deny that it's there. So, okay. Any other questions about the definition before we move on? It's a very British thing what I'm going to do next, and that's to lay out the history, but it's going to be important to understand what emerges. We don't do that a lot in New Testament studies in America, but it's important to do. Questions? We good? All right. Adding the lens to approach, you've got to understand, I've already said this, but you've got to understand that any given paradigm is an interaction between multiple strands of influence. It's not like that this just emerges on the scene just out of nowhere. Multiple different tributaries have contributed to develop what we are now experiencing. And I've boiled it down to what I see as three sociological things that have happened. And eventually what we will move through multiple different tributaries, we'll do the sociological ones, then we'll move to how we got close to New Testament studies. Then we'll talk about even within New Testament studies what was happening that allowed it to be primed and ready to interact with this. Okay? So, first of all, three strands of influence that were happening in American society that allowed empire studies to come on the scene in biblical scholarship. Number one, the emergence of a global society. The globalization through technology in the 20th and the 21st century, what it has done is not just shrunk the earth, but it's allowed us to hear voices that throughout history have been marginalized. We can hear them more easily. It's not that they were never speaking. So we just never had the opportunity to hear them more clearly. Specifically, the voices of the marginalized that I'm referring to are things like the feminist theologians, African-American theologians, two-thirds world theologians, and many others. And the emergence of these voices, what has happened is whenever we're hearing their perspectives, it's causing us to have an introspective moment. Whenever we stop and we say, huh, if their perspective is so drastically different than mine, then what is it that they're seeing that I'm not seeing? And the moment that you look through their eyes is the moment you start to actually critique your own interpretation. So the fact that the world has gotten smaller technologically will have impact in multiple areas of interpretation, of studies, and we see it. I think it's one of the reasons why empire studies has emerged. Alternative perspectives are now most easily heard. Number two, there was an emergence of a religio-political perspective in America that fostered the opportunity for empire studies to come. So you can shorthand say the emergence of a religio-political perspective in America. And that last part's important because of what I'm about to describe. In America, we have a belief that we've consistently functioned off a belief of a separation of church and state. We've actually convinced ourselves that it was a feasible reality. But you'll hear this rhetoric really amping up. We've talked about this some in the political debates that are going to be coming here in the next 9 months. Why? Because, my goodness, we're going to be electing a new president. And one of the things they're going to do whatever they can to convince us is that they have a faith, but it doesn't affect them in their legislation and in the public. Why? Because there's a separation of church and state. Now, whether or not you think that that is folly, which I may be more inclined to fall in that category, or what I believe doesn't affect what I do. Okay. Well, even the evens believe. At least they shudder. That was a biblical allusion. I know you caught it. Anyway, okay. But what started happening was we began in America to realize that this concept of the separation of church and state was not as clear-cut as what we would have liked for it to have been. Especially when we began to realize that that is not the way that it was in the ancient world. Richard Horsley, though, says this. He says, as a result of the bourgeois revolutions of the late 18th century, church and state not only became separate, but they agreed not to interfere in each other's designated jurisdictions. Correspondingly, Christian theology and biblical studies, focused primarily on religious affairs, tended to lose sight of the political and economic dimensions of life with which the Bible is concerned. In other words, what you got is a lot of different scholars that would see Jesus and Paul as apolitical. They are not political figures at all. They're spiritual. Have you ever heard that? As a matter of fact, even in the past 5 years, if you would utter that Jesus was a political figure, you'd get people that'd be very upset with you. Mark Moore's dissertation that he did on the canonic politics of Jesus was controversial for some people because Jesus is not political. But the problem is, that's not the way the ancient world functioned, or even a lot of the world functions today. But specifically the ancient world, we began to notice there was at least two reasons why church and state were inextricably linked. Specifically in Rome, number one, the national security of Rome depended upon the gods. Therefore, Rome was the agent of the gods, the emperor was the agent of the gods, and if you discredit or dishonored or shamed them, then the whole national security of the political institution could be at risk. That's the way Rome functioned. So we can look at the texts that were written in the Roman world as if there's a separation of church and state, but you're denying the historical reality of the way in which they were viewing it. Second, the imperial cult as an institution itself suggests that church and state wasn't separate in the Roman world. Now, I know we've talked about this, but just to refresh everybody's memories, what is the imperial cult? The worship of the emperor as a god, or at least as connected to the gods, because more than likely he wasn't going to be worshipped until he died, unless your name's Caligula, Nero, or Domitian. As a result of that, that started the understanding, we start to see another element of influence to say the separation of church and state is actually distorting the interpretation of the scriptures and not contributing to it. Warren Carter says this, the guy that wrote the book that you guys are dealing with, which actually it's kind of funny. My advisor at Edinburgh is right now in a scholarly war with Warren Carter over a book he wrote on Pontius Pilate. But anyway, previous scholarship, he says, has studied church and state in the New Testament, often concentrated on those texts that make overt references to the state, i.e. obedience to the difficult Romans 13, Jesus' words about paying taxes, etc. Previous work has also focused on Roman backgrounds to the New Testament. Notice the difference he's making here. It's not that Roman backgrounds has never been engaged before, but listen to what he says. Recent scholarship, though, differs from and extends previous work in both method and content. In this method, it draws on sociology, anthropology, archaeology, and classics. In its content, it recognizes that Roman power pervades every aspect of the world from which the New Testament text emerged, whether Judea and Galilee or cities such as Rome, Corinth, and Ephesus. Hence, the New Testament texts do not negotiate Roman power only at a few obvious points, whereas in other passages, the empire disappears. You see what he said there? It's not just like every once in a while the New Testament's like, oh, I guess we'll talk about the empire now. He goes on, he says, rather, every chapter and every pericope are products of empire. The texts continually assume and engage aspects of imperial structures and claims in relation to understandings of God's purposes for the world. At times, they imitate and perpetuate these structures. At times, they contest and subvert them with God's different purposes. What's he saying? What's the difference here that he's establishing? Church and state allowed us to look at a separation between the spiritual things of Jesus, and we really aren't going to pay attention to the political because he was apolitical. But what he says was, you're ignoring the fact that every single pericope is emerging out of a situation where there are warring empires. To ignore an imperial context is to ignore a major key interpretive lens that allows us to actually understand what is happening in the text. You see how we're pulling in everything that we've been talking about before? There was a hand up. Michael, yeah?
Yeah, I was just curious. Do these they think that that Paul and Jesus were overtly, like they were intentionally trying to be a political figure, or did it happen because the people viewed them in that light?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's a little bit of a subtle nuance let me just explain. Basically, this is what the empire studies would say back. Now, notice, I'm informing you, but I'm not totally, wholeheartedly endorsing empire studies yet. And you'll see my distinction next class period. But this is what I would say. You cannot say the things Jesus and Paul was saying without, by default, being political. You can't come onto a scene and say Matthew 4:17, and then in Rome just to say, oh, silly spiritualist. You can't say, repent, for the kingdom of God is near. You cannot say that and think that you're not political. Therefore, the very message of Jesus, whether they wanted to be political or not, by default, what they were saying made them political. You see my...
perception, or is it
a... But what is the perception? If you're saying, I'm establishing a kingdom...
Is it the people that are making it political? I mean, it could be inherently political because of the nature of what you're saying, but not in reality, like necessarily I'm a politician.
Right, yeah, and this is the good nuance. I mean, the nuance here that I would add to this is this. You may not be partaking inside of a political arena that is defined by senators and congressmen, and yet I can be a very political person. For example, Shane Claiborne is considered very politically explosive, and he would never associate himself as a congressman or a senator. And yet his very message,
because of the repercussions,
is political. No, because he doesn't believe in that system. So rejecting the system doesn't make you apolitical. It makes you offering a different politic. And that's the whole point of Mark Moore's dissertation, canonic politics. How does it make sense for a kingdom to succeed through the king saying the way you do it is by self-abnegation? That may be a foolish politic, but it's a politic nonetheless. You see the difference? I mean, I like the way that you're interacting with that. But it's one of those things where... sometimes people will put you in categories you don't want to be in. Sometimes it's in their categories that's insufficient to describe who you actually are. Nevertheless, if you're speaking the language of kingdom, by default, you're going to be political. You may not be political like Rome. You may have a totally different politic, but you would still fall into the realm of politics. Because you're trying to organize a whole new kingdom that is going to rule the earth. And Rome says, excuse me, we're already doing that? Well, yeah. But not for long. The third thing that allowed empire studies to emerge, sociologically speaking, is that it began to emerge in other disciplines. See, notice right now, we're not into the biblical studies yet. I've given you some biblical quotes from biblical scholars, but I'm showing how empire studies migrates into biblical studies. It begins to emerge really in four different areas that we can observe, obviously. Pinpointing exactly which one came first is not the point of this. It's to show that they did emerge. Number one, sociological studies. Primarily with the work of John H. Kautsky, which I guess I could write these names for you. Not that I'll put it up there in case you want to look up their work. But Kautsky and then Gerhard Lenski, they began to study agrarian societies. And in the agrarian societies, they began asking the question, number one, who gets what? And number two, why does that person get what they get? And as a result, they began to observe different relationships between the sovereigns of a society and the subjects. Number two, we started to see this develop in literature. Edwards said in 1993, which actually it's something he's reflecting upon from the 80s, writes the book Culture and Imperialism. That's Edwards said, and this is literature, where he begins to study empire, what I'm calling empire studies in literature, Edwards said. One of the key people that post-colonial theorists constantly point back to is Edwards said. Post-colonial theorists, we talked about that a couple weeks ago. It's not important for right now. We saw it emerge in history with the works of Howard Zinn, if that name rings a bell, who just passed away a year or two ago. We also saw it emerging in politics, critiques of politics, by a guy named Arif Dirlik. Arif Dirlik. And so you see all these different types of studies that are surrounding biblical studies interacting with the sociological phenomenon that I'm calling empire studies. And then it eventually made it to general world religious studies, in particular through studies by a guy named David Chittister. Chittister, this is general world religious studies. Chittister. As well as Lionel Jensen. Okay? So because it's we had the globalization, we're hearing multiple voices now at a rapid pace. The kind of the decomposition of, or the deconstruction of, the concept of church and state in America, which, I'll be honest with you, the events of 9/11 really added to that as well. And why? Because the rhetoric used by our political leaders to describe what this war was going to be had major religious overtones. And people started going, hold on, what? But I thought there was separation of church and state. How could you be quoting a scripture justifying our actions that are moving forward? For example, in the rallies, and this is the conflation of church and state right now, and all you have to do is just go to a 4th of July service in any church around, and you'll see that the separation of church and state is something that's been deteriorating. Matter of fact, there's a quote of a rally for Bush in his second term over in Poplar Bluff, where the guy gets up there and he's, you know, saying, you know, basically, go Bush, go Bush. He says, and you know, and basically at the very end of his rant, he says, God, for we are committed to America and the pursuit of the war on terror and to Jesus Christ. And what you see is the conflation of language is pointing to a deterioration of something bigger, and that's church and state. They're starting to come in together. Which your opinion on that obviously is something that's beyond the point that it's a historical reality that's led to where we're at now in New Testament studies. The third reason, or the third influence, was the emergence of empire studies in other disciplines, and that tends to happen. When one discipline gets on something, the other disciplines that have eyes on other disciplines will say, huh, wonder if I could apply that to what I'm doing. Within the new, now I'm going to move, within New Testament studies, there are other different elements that were developing that primed New Testament studies to interact with empire studies. Okay, so we've been talking sociologically broad. Now I'm moving down saying what was happening during the same time period with inside of New Testament studies that prepared us to be actually enter into the discussion of empire studies. First of all, the historical critical approach was enriched through interdisciplinary studies. In the 70s and 80s in particular, New Testament scholarship began to experiment with bringing sociological findings and its findings of anthropology into our interpretation of the scriptures. The major pioneers in this were Wayne Meeks. If you don't know that name, you need to. Very, very important writer on this issue. Wayne Meeks, who wrote the book The First Urban Christians, The Social World of the Apostle Paul. He wrote that in 83. I'll give you a couple more names. Some of the more recent pioneers of this is Bruce Molina, who is basically a sociologist that applies his models, be it for better or worse, to New Testament interpretation. And then you also have Gerd Tyson, who's one of the major pioneers. Tyson spelled the German way, not the English. I-S-S-E-N. Gerd. What a good German name. Who wrote Sociology of Early Palestinian Christianity of 1978. He's the one that wrote In the Shadow of the Galilean. And what he's doing is he's taking his sociological studies and he's put it into a historical narrative as a way of showing the significance of sociology studies in relation to New Testament studies. Yes? Oh, the historical critical approach is enriched through interdisciplinary studies. Which, what does that mean? Interdisciplinary studies.
Multiple disciplines interacting.
Yeah, exactly. It's
taking sociology, anthropology, hitting on some historical work, and presenting that.
Exactly. It's finding different, using different findings in other disciplines like sociology or anthropology, bringing their findings into the interpretation of the scripture. So you have interdisciplinary studies that's happening there.
Shane, would you put Rodney Stark in the category with those authors?
Yeah, yes, I would.
More modern, but
his would be more recent, and Rodney Stark would be The difference is this. Like, I'm reflecting in particular on The Rise of Christianity by Rodney Stark. And he's more asking if there's sociological explanations for the arrival of Christianity, more than he's trying to unpack the sociological reality of the ancient world. In other words, he's applying sociology in a slightly different manner in that book. Now, his other books may be doing what Wayne Meeks does, but what Wayne Meeks does is he says, let's look at the Roman, the direct historical sources and the indirect sources to figure out what's in the Roman world and then see how that helps illuminate some of the texts. Rodney Stark is saying, sociologically, is it feasible for the church to be growing from 120 to 3,000 to 5,000. And then he says, let me give you, he doesn't believe in those numbers. He says, but let me give you an explanation of sociological explanation, not a supernatural one, of how Christianity could have emerged as the dominant religion of the empire only 300 years into its existence. So his trajectory using sociology is different than what you'd find in Meeks and Molina. And yet he's still a sociologist bringing his study to Christianity, which has allowed us to take his work and then move that into interpretation in other ways. So yes, but like one step away. Yeah, good question. Yeah.
Is there anyone who's taking this academic stuff and writing about how to put it into practice or how it affects living out Christianity?
Well. Directly, no. Indirectly, yes. In other words, Shane Claiborne's book, Jesus for President, that would fall into this category. However, he's not taking, well, he does take some of the work of, like, we'll get to Richard Horsley in a minute, who's one of the major movers and shakers of the empire studies today. And I guess the closest the answer would be Claiborne. I don't know if I can think of anybody else. But they're out there. Stanley Hauerwas, he would have been one of the ones, though he wasn't using empire studies to do it. He was just a theologian, an ethicist, that's taking what he finds in the Bible and applying it to the modern day context. That's why Resonant Aliens with Hauerwas and Willimon, which obviously, you know, John Howard Yoder. But even then, they're using more ethics and theology to give us imperial interaction more than they are sociology and anthropology. Yeah, but they would fall into this category. They're linked, but they're not directly in the mainstream. Yeah, good questions. Okay. So this starts to develop. However, what you find in some of their conclusions, like with Meeks in particular, is that they're still measuring their conclusions of sociology and anthropology from an elite perspective. They're still not, which one of the key goals of empire studies is to look at the text from below up, from the dominated perspective, and not from the sovereign's perspective. But Wayne Meeks, for example, he says this, after he describes the general terrain of the Roman Empire after the victory of Octavian over Mark Antony at Actium, he says, after that, he says, a general climate of stability and security for urban people in the provinces existed. Well, from the sovereign's perspective, that is true. But from the subjects of the empire, stability is not what they would call what has just happened to them. You see the difference? If not, you'll see it eventually. Okay. Okay, number two. Within New Testament scholarship, another thing that really helps develop empire studies was the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Why? First of all, the discovery of Dead Sea Scrolls. Let me just give you a brief history. 1940s, Bedouin cousins that were out there, you know, out in the kind of the wilderness area, the Qumran region, stumble upon the greatest archaeological find maybe in the past 1,500 years, where they recover in 11 different caves over 900 documents from the 2nd century BC to the 1st century CE. That's the history of it. Why would it be significant, though, for empire studies? What was found in there? Anybody in my Mark class better be able to give a testimony at some level.
Isn't it like in the textual criticism, like they were able to
look at documents and compare? Yeah, it really helped us with textual criticism because some of our earliest documents, it moved up some of our earliest, especially the Masoretic text, up by like 600 years. So for like the reliability of the scriptures, that was really good. But sociologically speaking, something else was happening, what we found inside of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Well, it's like a political community.
Yeah. The entire community defines itself in political terms. They have separated themselves into the wilderness as a protest against the evil Jewish elite known as the Pharisees and Sadducees that they see as compromising with the empire. And I had my Mark class read the War Scroll. And what do you find in there?
All sorts of political, militant stuff against Roman.
Yeah. You find this battle, this cosmic battle against the sons of light and the sons of darkness, who are the army of Belial, otherwise known as the Kittim. And the Kittim, scholars agree, is the Roman Empire. And the whole document is intending to show the destruction of the Roman Empire at the hands of God's people. Very anti-imperial document, wouldn't you agree? I mean, and what started happening is whenever this discovery did, and some scholars started saying with the New Testament studies, huh, I wonder if some of our documents are kind of like that. I wonder if some of our documents do the same thing. And if they do, what would be the implications of that? The discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls opened our eyes up to maybe sitting there saying, okay, maybe these communities living in an empire had different agendas than what we assumed. It's not just a spiritual separation, it's a political one. Yes?
Would they be a voice as a subject?
Oh, absolutely. Because they're not just a subject of Rome, they're a subject of the Jews. Because the Jews looked at them as kind of the outcasts of society. They looked at themselves, they redefined their society though in terms of, we are the chosen people that are called out because of the prophetic proclamation Isaiah 40. We have been called out, set aside, purified, so that whenever the teacher of righteousness or whenever God decides to move, depending on which document you read in the Qumran scrolls, comes, we will be the ones that he will enlist to take over the Kittim. Yeah, so they were subjects not only of Rome, but even of the Jews. Because the Jews were the ones that held the temple. They were the ones that had the political control in the Jewish, in Judaism. They didn't. They created their own politics as a separate group. Number three, the imperial perspective was enriched through viewing the empire through the subject's perspective. And this is something I've already alluded to. What starts happening in the New Testament perspective, in the New Testament studies, is that in light of these other two influences, they start saying, huh, what if we looked at the New Testament writers not as just spiritual guides, but as subjects of an empire, of people that were dominated, aliens, in a land that wasn't their own? What if we looked at them as from the subject's perspective? And this really kind of, this really challenges, number one, a false assumption that sociology, anthropology, helped us see. The false assumption was this. Protests, traditionally it was believed that protests against the empire were seen as evident whenever there were violent revolutions. That's when there was protest. Whenever there was an uprising that had to be put down, either a successful uprising or an unsuccessful one. That's whenever the subjects were protesting the empire. But what we began to notice was, actually, there were other protests going on behind the scenes that led to the uprising. And the work really comes out in James C. Scott. This is a name I'm going to want you to know. We're going to talk about him more in depth tomorrow, but I'm going to give you a Cliff Notes version of what he brought to the table. James C. Scott. He is not a biblical scholar, although he has spoken at the SBL because of his influence on New Testament interpretation in the last 10 to 15 years, 20 years. SBL is a Society of Biblical Literature. It's a conference that will be happening in November. James C. Scott wrote two books. The first one, Weapons of the Weak. Well, at least these two books. These are the two more significant books. Weapons of the Weak. The subtitle is Everyday Forms of Peasant Resistance. That's his, primarily that's his field work of this Malaysian community, this village that he did, that he made these sociological observations. And then he wrote, and that was published in 1987, I believe, 87. And then he published in 1992 a book called Domination in the Arts of Resistance, Hidden Transcripts. And we're going to define hidden transcripts and that stuff tomorrow. But what he found was this. Let me just give you his results, and then we'll deal with his results tomorrow. What he found was that violent forms of resistance against the dominant societal structures. Okay, did you understand that sentence? violent forms of resistance against the empires, or against the, not necessarily an empire, but whoever was in charge, were not the only means of resistance being practiced on an everyday basis. Matter of fact, there's an Ethiopian proverb that's constantly quoted in empire studies, and even as the very first quote at the very beginning of the book Domination and the Arts of Resistance by James C. Scott. And the Ethiopian, it's a peasant proverb, something that the peasants would say to each other. And this is what it says. It says, "When the great lord passes, the wise peasant bows deeply and silently farts." Okay? Let that sink in. A peasant proverb was, whenever the great lord passes by, you bow down as deeply as you can and you silently fart. What is it saying? Let's get past the fart language and move into the... What is it saying? Is it saying anything?
Rebel silently.
Yeah. That there's more, ways of rebelling against the sovereigns than merely picking up a weapon and trying to fight them. He's saying, I'll give you your due, but I don't belong to you at all. And what he began to notice was, inside of this village, those types of resistance were occurring all over the place. One of the reasons why he calls them hidden transcripts. Warren Carter writes this. He says, "Often in peasant societies, resistance is expressed in more covert, self-protective, and calculated ways. Because they know who they are. They know who has the biggest stick on the block. These acts might include cheating on taxes, sabotage, go slows. This is really fascinating. What he found was sometimes whenever one of the ways the peasants would resist was they would cut down production by about 2-3% a day. And you're thinking, okay, big deal. Add that up over a year and you've just robbed your sovereign by thousands of dollars. These acts might include cheating on taxes, sabotage, go slows, apparently inadvertent non-expressions of honor, a sneer, or no greeting at all. You act like you see the guy that walks by that you're supposed to be in service to, and you act like you don't even see him and just keep moving. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you. Had I would have bowed down. And you walk away going, pfft. Subversive songs and stories. You can read a lot about those songs in antebellum slavery. Man, a lot of their songs had nothing to do about what they were singing about. Subversive songs and stories, seizing initiative from the powerful. These discrete acts of nonviolent active resistance challenge the public and official versions of reality. We'll talk about that more tomorrow. They secure some honor and dignity for the powerless and keep alive hopes and visions of different forms of societal interaction. In other words, what is on the surface isn't always what appears. It isn't always what is reality. Therefore, the only time in a historical document whenever we see an uprising, it doesn't mean that everybody in the empire until that moment was like, I love the empire. The empire's great. It's saying, no, there's other things that are happening that every once in a while, the historical anomaly of resistance is the violent uprising. But resistance is always happening. It's just done in more self-protective, subversive ways. You see how that could have an impact on a biblical interpretation? If not, we'll get to it more tomorrow. Where are we at time-wise? Ooh! Okay. We'll talk about some of the major figures tomorrow in empire studies, some of the pioneers, and then we'll move into defining it more pictorially. I'm going to show you guys some charts of the way in which James C. Scott developed something, shows what I'm adding to it, and then how you can apply it to what you're doing. Okay? Love you guys. See you tomorrow.